Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. You might call today's show two victory laps and one no victory lap, plus a 50-year-old piece of gold. The two victory laps, we will meet two of the winners of important New York City primary races, Alvin Bragg for Manhattan DA and Antonio Reynoso for Brooklyn Borough President. The no victory lap conversation will be about Sha'Carri Richardson not getting to go to the Olympics because of a positive marijuana test. Why are they still enforcing against the use of an increasingly legal non-performance enhancing drug? And we'll explore the role of race in why it was ever enforced in the first place. And our 50-year-old piece of gold will continue our series on 1971 as an amazing year in music with the enduring impact of the Marvin Gaye classic, What's Going On. But we begin with victory lap number one. Alvin Bragg won the Democratic primary to succeed Cy Vance Jr. as Manhattan District Attorney. For those of you who didn't follow this race, Bragg is 47 years old. He's from Harlem, went to Harvard Law School. He's been a prosecutor at both the state and federal levels and a civil rights attorney. Some of you may have seen that he was endorsed by former U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara, who Bragg used to work under in the Southern District office. He was also endorsed by the New York Times, which said he has the nimbleness and moral compass that Manhattan needs and is committed to reasonable reforms to improve both policing and prosecutions. Some of those proposed reforms have gotten the most press attention, especially a list of more minor offenses. Bragg says it no longer makes sense to prosecute. As Manhattan DA, he will also inherit the prosecutions related to the Trump Organization, unless there's a surprisingly swift plea deal in those cases. And although there's a general election in November yet to be held, since Republicans don't ever win that seat, let's meet the very likely next Manhattan DA, Alvin Bragg. Mr. Bragg, we really appreciate you making some time for us in an eventful week for you. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you so much for having me on. Good morning, and I look forward to talking.
Can we talk about your bio a little bit first to help people get to know you? Where in Harlem did you grow up, and what were some of your early experiences that made you think you'd want to go to law school?
Sure. I grew up in central Harlem, starting out north and in Esplanade Gardens, for those who are familiar with the geography, in the 140s and then moved to the 130s. And I went to law school in large part because of my early experiences. You mentioned I'm 47, so I grew up during the height of the crack cocaine epidemic. And before I was 21, I had a gun pointed at me six times, three by the NYPD during unconstitutional stops, but also three by people who were not police officers. And so that combination of experiences, focused me on the intersection of public safety and fairness, and the fact that, we need both. And I focused my career both as a prosecutor and a civil rights lawyer in large part because of those early experiences.
How about that transition? Why did you want to be a civil rights attorney at first? And what made you want to go from that into prosecution?
So there were always dual interests. When I was, my early role as a civil rights lawyer, I was also a criminal defense lawyer. So I was working on criminal cases at the same time. And the specific focus of my civil rights work was police accountability. So it was always under the umbrella of kind of a focus on criminal justice issues. And I started out criminal defense and civil rights, and then went to the New York State Attorney General's office, where I did kind of public corruption and civil rights work. And over time, as I was practicing, I realized really kind of the profound power and discretion of the prosecutor's office, and the ability and possibility to have a real positive impact. And that's why I pursued that ultimately.
Who was the New York State Attorney General when you were there? Which year was that?
So I started out, I had two stints. I was a junior lawyer under the Attorney General Elliot Spitzer. Then I went to the New York City Council, where I worked on defended progressive legislation passed by the council. Then I was a federal prosecutor under Preet Bharara, as you mentioned. And then I returned to the Attorney General's office and headed up the Social Justice Division, and then ultimately with the chief deputy overseeing the whole office under Attorney Generals Eric Schneiderman and Barbara Underwood.
Uh-huh. And today we have the expression progressive prosecutor, right, to refer to people who are looking to rebalance the fight against crime and the fight against unnecessary mass incarceration. How do you think the profession has evolved during your time as a state and federal prosecutor? And how do you think you have evolved on that spectrum over time leading up to this campaign?
So I'll talk about my own personal evolution first. You know, when I was in college, I was a intern, summer investigator at the Neighborhood Defender Service of Harlem, a pioneering public defender shop. In law school, I did criminal defense clinic. And as we noted, I started out as a criminal defense lawyer. So for me, really because of those early stops, I was very apprehensive about prosecution. And something I share with, you know, my law enforcement partners now, that the impact, what you do today in this stop will affect, you know, tomorrow's witness or victim. And in my case, you know, the trajectory of my career. But as I said, the more I sort of have worked in this space, I realized, the ability to affect change. So as a federal prosecutor, I prosecuted an FBI agent for lying. Also did, you know, public corruption, working on the case that led to the conviction of former Majority Senate Leader Malcolm Smith. So in my own personal view, kind of began to see prosecution more broadly. And then when I returned to the New York State Attorney General's office, you know, the opportunity, you know, then in leadership to focus on kinds of cases I like to do as Manhattan District Attorney, you know, prosecuting employers who were engaged in wage theft from hardworking workers, prosecuting landlords who harassed tenants out of their homes. That's my own sort of personal evolution. Mm-hmm. I think certainly nationally we've seen, you know, an important conversation, you know, triggered in part, you know, by, academic work. I think of, you know, Michelle, you know, Alexander's book and the new Jim Crow and Just Mercy by Bryan Stevenson and others, obviously, but have triggered this conversation. And then we've seen, you know, people run for office, talking about issues differently. I'd say starting right here in New York City, with my dear late friend, Ken Thompson, really is, I would say, kind of the 1.0 of starting to think about, 1.0 version of starting to think about prosecution differently. And then, of course, we've seen that grow and develop across the nation. I am unabashedly so, a kind of a Manhattan exceptionalist. I think Manhattan's the best place on earth. I've lived here my entire life. And I think it's a great opportunity. Obviously, the primary function is to serve Manhattan and to deliver our vision here. But I think it's true from hip hop to fashion to the arts, what happens in Manhattan travels. And so I think there's a great opportunity for what we do here to travel. And that's why getting it right in Manhattan is so important.
Well, listeners, we can take a few questions for the Democratic nominee for Manhattan DA, Alvin Bragg, 646-435-7280, 646-435-7280, or tweet a question at Brian Lehrer. Mr. Bragg, the New York Times endorsement of you noted that 80% of the cases prosecuted by the Manhattan DA's office in 2019 were misdemeanors, and that you plan to restructure the office to stop using the office to criminalize poverty. Would you put that the same way the Times did, that the current practices criminalize poverty?
I would. I think, and this is a very important point to me, you know, having spent my entire life, you know, one of the most affected communities by the criminal justice system, you know, what we're talking about on my block, and I think most blocks, are, you know, gun shootings, you know, things that, are public safety issues that are, you know, we need to urgently address, and not the kind of cases that consume much of the city's criminal docket. A case that really drew my attention, my father used to run homeless shelters, was a homeless person who was prosecuted for using a counterfeit bill to buy food and toothpaste. And he had some prior interaction with the criminal justice system. the attorney's office recommended a sentence of 5 to 10 years for, and I think it's apt to there say criminalized poverty, food and toothpaste. These are sort of, you know, human essentials. And you know, I don't think anyone's sitting around their kitchen table fretting about that from a public safety perspective. You know, I had a shooting down the block from me. A friend of mine was shot at. You know, he was not the intended target. This was just a couple of days ago. And so we need to shift the focus from, you know, much of what that 80% is about to the things that, I think are urgent, you know, public safety issues. And that's a priority for me.
Criminalizing toothpaste is one thing. The list of things that you campaigned on not prosecuting anymore has raised some eyebrows. As you know, a range of things from fair beating to resisting arrest as a standalone charge to many cases of gun possession to many traffic violations. Can we go down some of those for you to clarify for the listeners? Because they probably heard maybe sensational headline versions of these, and I'm sure they would like to hear you elaborate a little bit more in your own words. So on fare evasion, would paying to get on a bus or a subway in Manhattan in effect be optional with USDA?
So, you know, in credit here to the, you know, the current district attorney who started this practice, I view this as a you know, a civil matter, not a criminal one. So I think it's important on all of these to talk, well, for many of them, to say, you know, we're not talking about doing nothing. We're talking about whether there should be a criminal sanction. And so I think about, you know, I don't know if you've got an easy pass, if you're a driver, but, you know, someone goes through an easy pass. We don't, you know, have, you know, five police officers pull you over with guns drawn. You know, they send you a letter. You got to pay it. So it's not about, you know, having no government response, but it's about what do we use the most profound government power, the restriction of liberty, for. And I can, I'm just going to give you one example of just my framing on this, because I think it's important for people here. And they say, oh, you're not going to prosecute, it means you don't care. Well, no, that's not true. So I think of untaxed cigarette sales, which the NYPD at one point at the highest level decided to target. And we know those were mostly of younger black men, you know, selling them on street corners. Ultimately, you know, in one instance, you know, leading to the death of Eric Garner, who was accused of that, even though he was breaking up a fight. At the attorney general's office, you know, we had the same sort of call. What are you going to do on this? And we took a completely different, and I think far more effective approach. We said, well, how do these untaxed cigarettes end up here? And they were being shipped in the thousands by Federal Express and UPS in violation of law. So we sued them. We went to court. No one died. In one instance, we went to trial. And we got more than $100 million in untaxed revenue back to the city and state. And we took these untaxed cigarettes, you know, off the street. So that's, to me, an example just of sort of how we should be deploying government power. You know, so we should just not ignore the fact of fare evasion, but we shouldn't use a criminal sanction. You also noted... Go ahead. You noted resisting arrest. Many of these policies kind of come up from my experience growing up and my experience as a prosecutor. Now, resisting arrest, I've experienced both ways. I've had friends, you know, arrested for the standalone resisting arrest. And I always say, well, what was the person resisting? And if the officer can't tell me that, and I've experienced it both, I said, as a friend, as a defense lawyer, and as a you know, practicing lawyer, if there's no arrest that they were resisting, I found it's generally a pretext. It's for quote unquote mouthing off. And so I don't think those kind of prosecutions advance public safety. You know, I'll note, I have prosecuted someone for assaulting a police officer. That's a crime. Your assault is an issue, but the standalone resisting arrest, I found in my experience, to be pretextual, and it's not something that I think advances public safety. And there are other charges, obstructing governmental administration is also in that family, the things that people get arrested for, that I found to be oftentimes baseless and generally pretextual.
You know, I'll bet that'll surprise a lot of people to hear that anybody gets arrested for resisting arrest without the police officers attempting to arrest them for something else that, you know, precedes the resisting. That happens?
Yes, it happens. And, you know, I've gotten, as the defense lawyer in my friend group, I've gotten, you know, lots of calls in the middle of the night to help folks out. And that's been one that I've certainly seen. I would love to talk about gun possession because I do get asked about that a lot. And I think it's important to talk about and contextualize. So
good. Let me jump in here because we need to take a break at some point during this segment. So let me do it now so we can take a good deep dive on your relationship to gun possession charges. Because if there's anything that's gotten press during your run for DA, the nomination, it was that. So we'll dive into that for real with Alvin Bragg right after this. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. We're talking to the winner of the Democratic primary for Manhattan District Attorney, Alvin Bragg. We'll get to a few of your phone calls in a few minutes, 646-435-7280. If you have a question for him, 646-435-7280, or tweet a question at Brian Lehrer. And so gun possession. In this year of rising gun violence, obviously, it surprised some people who have heard this. Again, I say, as I did in the earlier part of the conversation, maybe as a sensational headline, and would love to hear you go deeper on it. When you say you're not going to prosecute some cases of possessing a gun, where does that come from? What distinction are you making? I know you're making some kind of a distinction between possessing an illegal weapon and shooting one. So go ahead and introduce people to your thinking on that.
Sure. Thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity. So, you know, I've dealt with guns both professionally and personally, right? So I have had, you know, an AK semi-automatic weapon pointed to my head by someone who was possessing it. That was alarming, disturbing, and this happened when I was, you know, a young teenager, and I remember this moment. That's very serious. You know, I've also, you know, had a family member whose best friend was shot and killed in front of him, and I will never forget the blank stare in that relative's eye. So I've got a lot of kind of personal context that helps me draw these lines. The best example, and what I've said on gun possession, is that, you know, we need to be very thoughtful about when we incarcerate. And so I've got two examples from my own life of times where I think gun possession charge would not have been appropriate. One is my father. He had an illegal gun in our home growing up in Harlem. I know this from as a child. You know, he wanted to protect the home. Saw him pull it out, and he thought we were being burglarized. And then when I got older, I told him, "Dad, you need to turn that gun in." He did that, you know, under sort of a gun, you know, kind of, it was a buyback gun, a kickback program. Uh-huh. You know, but the notion of being 65 years old at the time, a gun that had not been discharged in, you know, 35 years, you know, was possessed, it's a matter of defending the homestead, and one that...
Can I jump in for a second, only because your phone is breaking up a bit? I don't know if there's something you can do to be in as stable a spot as you can, but just it's getting a little hard to hear some of the answers for the listeners.
Oh, I'm sorry. Is this better?
I think so. So go ahead and we'll see.
Okay. So I was saying, you know, my father with a gun that I believe he you know, purchased lawfully in another state, you know, 30, 40 years ago, and had when I was growing up in Harlem, and, you know, used when he thought our home, used meaning, you know, he pulled it out and I saw the gun, you know, when we thought the home was being burglarized. And then as an adult, you know, I encouraged him, and he did, you know, turn the gun in. Because I said to him, I said, "Dad, you know, you're, you know, 60 some odd years old." This was some time ago. You know, this gun hasn't been discharged in years. Someone's going to come in here on a medical call for you. And you're going to end up in jail because of a gun. And that would be a case that wouldn't advance public safety. Now, that didn't happen. We turned the gun in. Mm-hmm. But that's one example of, I think, a gun possession charge that would just be ill-conceived. Another one, my brother-in-law was a college student, was engaged in a schoolyard fist fight. You mentioned I went to Harvard for law school, also went to Harvard for college. The kind of fist fight that at Harvard would have gotten you into some trouble, but I can assure you no one would have been arrested. He was at a historically black college. all of the boys involved in the fist fight were arrested. One of the boys had a gun on him. They charged all of the boys with constructive possession. And my brother-in-law did more than a year in jail for a gun that he had not touched and didn't know was there. I think that's a bad case. And so I just think we need to be thoughtful and always ask ourselves the question, will this case advance public safety? And I think the answer to that question should be, you know, our guidance. And it will take us to prioritizing the kind of cases that I think Manhattanites want us to prioritize.
And you've certainly gotten the attention of the conservative press on some of the things we were just talking about. A New York Post headline about you this week said, "Truly radical pro-crime ideas." The conservative magazine National Review has a headline that says, "Good news, criminals, Manhattan's next DA has your back." What would you say, not to those headline writers, but to ordinary people in Manhattan who read headlines like that and start out looking at you with a question in their heads about whether you are pro-crime or have criminals' backs?
Right. So the first thing I would have, and I think it's in the spirit of this conversation, is let's have a real dialogue. You know, let's talk and not, you know, stop at the headlines. I understand folks are busy and
whoops, I think we lost Alvin Bragg's line. You know
can
what
you
I think?
Hear me?
Oh yeah, now we can hear you. I think we're back. So try it again. We did hear you saying, "Let's try to have a real dialogue and look beyond those headlines." Okay, you know what?
Wow.
This is not working right at the moment. I think my producer's going to get on the line with you and try to call you back and see if we can stabilize this line. I know everybody wants to hear the answer to that particular question. We'll also get to some phone calls with Alvin Bragg, winner of the Democratic primary for Manhattan DA. And I think what's going to make sense here is to take another break. And that's good news, listeners, because it means there'll be a point later in the show where we won't have to take one at all. So stay with us, Brian Lehrer on WNYC. We continue with Alvin Bragg. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and I think the prize for winning the primary for Manhattan DA should be a better cell phone. So let's see if we can continue with Alvin Bragg and if we have better reception now. Okay, you were talking back to the headline writers from the New York Post and National Review. Want to give it another shot?
Sure, and I apologize. I don't know what's happening. I was saying, you know, my day job, I'm a visiting professor at New York Law School, and I teach criminal law classes. And I encourage, robust dialogue from people from all political viewpoints. And so I think the first starting point is, like, let's have a real conversation. And let's have that conversation be rooted in the data, which in my op-eds I talk to and cite about. Actual experiences in the courtroom, which I have, and I think some of these pundits do not have. And then also what's happening on the street, which, I know, again, from my own experiences, and these aren't just things in the past. I mean, I've had shootings in and around my block a lot recently. So the notion that I don't care about this or I'm not focused on this is really antithetical to reason, right? I've got to walk these streets. My family, loved ones walk in the street. So my response is, yes, of course I care. And if you look at my body of work, you look at what I've done, I've worked on both public safety issues and fairness issues. I find that a lot of people pushing this narrative don't want to talk about the fairness part. They don't want to talk about the police accountability. They don't want to talk about the effects and the collateral consequences of these cases that have nothing to do with public safety. So I just urge all of us to have a robust, full dialogue. I welcome these kind of opportunities to talk to you. I would talk to the folks who are they invited me on who have different viewpoints, but really to work through, and I can point them to the data and I can point them to my experiences in the courtroom, the kind of cases I've done. But fundamentally, I think something I want to underscore is that the equity and fairness issues I talk about are also public safety issues, right? So I know from my experience that we can't build cases without community trust, without victims coming forward, and without witnesses. Many of the things I talk about are going to help with that. You know, not arresting people and alienating them for things that are junk cases. You know, people know that. It's not just the person you arrest, it's the whole community. I mean, I can tell you, you know, periods of time where, you know, people my age on my block weren't talking to the police at all because something had been done to one of us. Mm-hmm. So many of the measures I talk about are fairness and equity and accountability, which some are resisting, ultimately advance public safety because they help law enforcement make cases. And I know that, and I think I know that in a way that many of these pundits don't because I've done the work.
Michael in Laurelton, Queens, you're on WNYC with Manhattan DA nominee Alvin Bragg. Hello, Michael.
Hi, how you doing? I just wanted to congratulate Mr. Bragg on his win and indicate to him that I remember him as a youngster because I served with his mother. We were co-workers teaching mathematics in a state office building that I'd been to his home on several occasions. And I served with her for a number of years before she moved on to BMCC and had a great career, moved up and I think was number two person at the college. So I wanted to congratulate him and ask a question.
Wait a minute, Michael, I have a question for you first. What was Alvin like as a kid?
Oh, I didn't know him. I've seen him on certain occasions.
Oh, you didn't. Okay.
But I didn't know him personally. But I remember, I have to say that I remember when his mother was pregnant with him. And on occasion, I would see him when I go to her house. Or the family's house, and when they had parties and get-togethers.
Okay, I thought we could get a little inside information there, but but I guess not. Go ahead with your question, Michael.
I wanted to know, how does your office intersect with the city administration to help reduce crime in general and gun violence in particular?
Michael, thank you for your call.
Thanks so much also for mentioning my mom. It's been a real joy of this campaign. You know, my mom and my dad have both passed away relatively recently, and a real joy of the campaign to hear people who worked with them talk about that work with praise. They were both, you know, public servants, my mom an educator, my dad running homeless shelters. I think this question really is important. Because I talk a lot about the, you know, what the district attorney can do and in public safety, you know, can do a lot. But, you know, we're in the midst of obviously having a lot of turnover in city government and how we interact with others. And so the governor obviously had an announcement on guns yesterday. The mayor through the NYPD and through others will be focusing on this. And so I think that, particularly so this incoming class of leadership, I would, as district attorney, really be calling upon us to focus on all the above approach. So yes, you know, traditional prosecutions, you know, but also funding of our cure violence programs. These are folks who have been justice involved, who intervene often when there's a shooting. We know that there can be a retaliatory shooting, so they will intervene and try to defuse and take the temperature down. And the city, you know, funding that and partnering with those important thing that comes out of City Hall. You know, also, you know, the youth enrichment and prevention through that means. And then obviously, you know, the NYPD. So I look forward to and have been in that space. One of my roles as chief deputy in the New York Attorney General's office was interacting, you know, with others in government, the DA's offices, the law enforcement at City Hall. And I look forward to doing it so we can address these issues holistically.
Since you mentioned Governor Cuomo's first in the nation, state-level, state of emergency declaration for gun violence this week. Did you take a look at his 7-point plan? Do you think the state of emergency is just sensational headline grabbing? Do you think he's on to something? What's your take on that?
I think we should all be talking about the gun violence. It, to me, is an urgent issue. And so, you know, I welcome the governor talking about it. I do think that, you know, an action plan, a bullet plan is good. But, you know, what happens next is more important. And as, you know, a number of commentators point out, a lot of the responses really are city powers and come from the city. So, you know, I would hope that the governor and the mayor, who obviously have a relationship that we've seen play out publicly at times, you know, can coordinate on this. Because this is something that we need the state police and the NYPD, the governor and the mayor on. But the view of it through a public health lens and sort of what I would call kind of an all-of-the-above approach, I think, is important.
Ed, on the Lower East Side, you're on WNYC with Alvin Bragg. Hi, Ed.
Hi. Congratulations to the new district attorney. I'm an ordinary person.
Nominee.
Been here since 1963. I also was impressed by the endorsement by the New York Times, which I read every day, as well as reading every day the print editions of the New York Post. And I'm a little concerned listening to you this morning, because I read the endorsement. I am not worried personally, worried about being shot, although I live in one of the poorest districts in Manhattan, actually. But I am concerned about something that I don't think this radio station is actually very concerned about. I am concerned about the quality of life issues that most people in this city live with every single day. One of which, by the way, is as innocuous as sounding as fear beating, not paying the fare. That is extremely demoralizing for working people and a lot of people who pay the fare. And by having a district attorney, and you're not the first one, your predecessor, Vance, did the same thing, announced that, you know, he wasn't going to deal with any kind of enforcement of fare jumping, of course, therefore encouraging fare jumping. I'd also say the same things about you know, the conditions in the trains in general, including having to face every single elevator at the Broadway Lafayette station before the pandemic, seeing in the daylight, in daytime, along with other women, stepping into elevators where people have used it as a toilet.
Ed, I'm going to have to get a response because we're running out of time in the segment, but you put a lot of real issues for a lot of people on the table there. So, Mr. Bragg, how would you begin to respond?
Yeah, so those are significant issues, and I would sort of go back to when we were talking about fare evasion earlier and what I talked about on our untaxed cigarette enforcement. So, yes, those are all important issues. I don't think those are ones that we should criminalize. You know, having, you know, seen the effects of the system firsthand, I kind of know the power of, you know, the deprivation of liberty. But that doesn't mean we should ignore them, and that goes back, I think, to the last caller's issue. Coordinating with City Hall, working on some of the cleanliness issues in the district's attorney's office can be helpful. I view the DA as being a part of the board of trustees for the city, so helpful in incubating ideas and forwarding ideas. But I don't think, while I take the train, I pay my fare, I've you know, smelled the smell of urine in a train station, it's no good. We need to address that. But I think that's a separate issue from the spectrum of government powers, and the most, you know, punitive, you know, power is the restriction of liberty. And there's so many things we can do between there. And I think that I want to welcome to be a part of that conversation with, you know, city council members, the mayor, and others. But I don't think we should be reflectively going to incarceration for the issues you flag.
So last question, and kind of a follow-up to Ed, and kind of big picture, the number of murders in New York City, as you well know, declined from 2,245 in 1990 to 289 by 2018. Through the mass incarceration era, the broken windows era, and until the pandemic, through the de Blasio starting to pull back on those things era. So if it wasn't from the so-called broken windows approach of cracking down on these small crimes to not signal to criminals they could get away with big crimes, what, in your view, did make New York and most other American cities so much safer over the last 30 years?
You know, so this is a complex issue which academics have written about, and I think there's no authoritative answer. I think you're onto something when you note that it wasn't just New York City. It was many other cities. And so I think it's a combination of issues, macroeconomic issues, things that were done in various cities. But I think, and maybe just to pick a some piece of it in the time that allowed, I think what we should not go back to, what I heard some say, some respond to that, is sort of, stop and frisk and saying that that was a driver of it. When I was at the New York Attorney General's office, we looked at every single stop for a four-year period and analyzed the disposition of cases that grew out of it. And of all the stops, only 0.1% resulted in a conviction for a gun offense. So to me, that speaks to the efficacy of the program. So I didn't exactly answer the why, because I think that's a complicated, longer academic. But the what not to go back to, I think, is to me very important. So I hope it's okay that I pieced out that part. But
yeah, but Bill Bratton, former police commissioner, would say there's a big difference between broken windows, going after the small things when they occur, and stop and frisk, which was like this ridiculously huge dragnet.
Yeah, so I'll respond directly to broken windows, and you're right, there's a distinction. I didn't mean to conflate the two. The authors of Broken Windows, the living author, wrote a look back, sometime after the initial one, and made the extraordinarily important point, which I've been trying to convey during this, which is that they said if there's a broken window, we should fix it, lest disorder result. But what they didn't say is that we should incarcerate the kid who threw the rock. Mm. So, yes, we should address the issues that your last caller mentioned, the urine and the train stations and the other things that we cause quality of life. But that's different. And the authors of the Broken Windows thesis, made this clear, been criminalizing and locking everyone up in the process. So I think that's an important point, and that's what has been a through line in my career. Like, yeah, let's address the untaxed cigarette sales, but let's do it in a smart way. Let's go to, I often say, let's follow the money, that kind of issue. Let's follow the money and find the principal wrongdoer. Let's address the root causes. And so, we don't want to have broken windows, but we don't want to incarcerate the person who's throwing the rock. And I think that's an important distinction.
Manhattan DA nominee Alvin Bragg, thank you so much for coming on with us. Congratulations again on your nomination after a hard-fought primary. Best of luck accomplishing all your goals in the job. I think if you win, we all win. And we hope you'll keep coming on with us once you're in office.
I welcome the conversation. I thank you. And I'll make sure when I come on that my phone is better.
That's a deal. Thank you so much.